Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
They need, maybe a slight improvement. I think there was a fair range. Some of that, I'm sure, was limited trade. But on average, I would call it fully steady for last week on the Fed cattle market.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel, what does he see moving markets this week?
You kind of got, sort of opposing forces here. Box beef has been, stagnant to a little weaker. On the one hand, seasonally, we kind of tend to think of fed cattle markets starting to drift off a little bit here into the middle of the year. But at the same time, slaughter rates have been good. I think feedlots are pretty current. So, again, we've kind of got this balance of forces right now, and nothing really that would, grab a hold of this market and push it in a vastly different direction.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
With the big, big move out of wheat today leading the grain markets higher.
Steve Georgie is president of Allendale on USDA's latest World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, or WASD.
And at one point going limit up, KC wheat was up 70 cents. We settled right near that limit, but not on limit. But I think, as you mentioned, that is a big reason and why we're doing that. Looking at good to excellent numbers week after week, we know it has been tough. Now they've kind of confirmed that here today and really seeing that decline in those wheat areas. And now it has shown on a balance sheet. So the market is almost getting ready to say, hey, if we've seen one instance in which we've gone ahead and cut production and cut numbers, this is only going to lead for further cuts down the road. Now, I don't know if that will be the case or not, but you look at that, the market was prepared for some of that rhetoric here today, but yet we still were able to climb. We had a very strong close, closed into new contract highs here for Kansas City wheat, and that certainly looks good. So we'll see if we can get that follow through again tomorrow, at least for the wheat market.
Talks about inflation, equities, and the stock market.
And it's a lot of that becomes feelings, right? Hearsay. What do we get? You've had a stock market that over the last 6 years had gone from 18,000 to 36. It doubled. So 36,000 for the Dow and some change. Now we're sitting just over 31,000 here today. We've had about a 5,000-6,000 point retracement, and guys are now concerned yet again that maybe we can continue to grind lower as far as our equity markets. And so the big thing that we're watching right now, as you mentioned, inflation. It is hard. It's been very, very hard. How do we curb inflation? We know that it's tough to find products. We know there's supply chain problems and issues, and those are getting worse. And so this is where that fear and panic may be worse in the short term here the next few months as we finish this quarter, because we saw after first quarter GDP was down. So if we get another quarter with negative GDP, now you're going to have every TV station, you name it, whatever, talking about we're now in a recession. So as you start seeing that, that has a very negative connotation. It has a very negative demeanor to it. And it is fear coming out of a market versus coming into a market. And that may keep things under pressure here, at least for the next while, until we figure out where we currently stand. But it's almost like we're preparing for that recessionary talk to happen here at the end of June. But we need to be very careful of that. Because in the big picture, when we talk about the grain markets and we talk about why we're at such high prices for a lot of this stuff is because we have seen this big managed money, the big pool of money come pouring into a market, and we need that help in order to get us to these price levels. Pure speculation isn't going to get you there. But you've got this idea, bigger money wants to come in, own commodities. Well, what's going to happen if these equities continue to have pressure? You're going to find commodities have pressure right along with it, because that big pool of money now is going to say, hey, guess what? I don't want to be as long, or I don't want as much risk when you have other risk that's hitting you from a different side. So you see that almost that, hey, I'm going on a defense mode, and you start to see that big pool of money start to tighten. So we got to be prepared for that. Yes, things may be bullish out there. Things could be friendly. They could be whatever. But the equities right now are kind of showing that hat, saying, hey, guys, be careful. Because if equities continue to decline, that may keep this rally that we've seen, or this market move and this all this hype and excitement, it might take it down a notch. So equities will be playing a big part of what we're going to do here as we go into the next few quarters.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
450 tractors basically are sold in April 2022, and that represents about 1,200 combines to date.
Kurt Blade, Senior Vice President of Ag at AEM, the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
You know, Tony, you say this correctly. Combines are, you don't wake up tomorrow and decide to buy a combine. You have to think about that. That's got to fit into your business operation. So that just kind of gives you a pretty good indication of the scale of farming in the Midwest and in the United States, but also kind of talk about how serious farmers are about taking advantage of some of this technology. So these are, although you could say small numbers with, 450, but you could also say that 450 times the price of a new combine, that represents a pretty sizable number of sales.
It's one thing for ag to understand what's happening, but how do we get that message to others?
As you know, there's a lot of arrows pointing at the ag industry right now, whether it's an environmental group or consumer advocacy group or whoever it might be. So we think it's really important to tell ag story and to tell modern ag story. I hear a lot of, I don't know who I can attribute this to, but someone has, I've heard say once that if you haven't been on a farm in 10 years, you really haven't been on a farm. Because the technology is changing that fast. So one of the things that we take very seriously at AEM is that communication and educating the beltway, educating those policymakers and regulators of what's going on the production side, what's going on the technology side that really is allowing farmers to produce more with less and have a much smaller environmental footprint and really, maximize their output with just by adopting some pretty cool new technology. We've done that a lot of different ways. In fact, most recently, in March, we had what we called the Celebration of Modern Agriculture on the National Mall, where we had a couple of dozens of major pieces of equipment right there on the National Mall, where we invited senators and policymakers and regulators from EPA and USDA and OSHA, all to kind of walk around and see the equipment firsthand and get a feel for the scale, but also get a sense for what manufacturers are doing to solve the challenge of sustainability while producing more with less.
He also talks about a new study that looks at the future of food production.
Well, so AEM, kind of in our mission for the last few years, we've been releasing really good kind of industry position papers. That really kind of is a gift to the entire ag industry to help spur some conversation. And building on that tradition, during the pandemic, we started putting together a group of about 20 different executives and futurists within our member companies and representing agriculture. We tried to build out some scenarios of what the future is going to look like in the next 10 to 15 years, not looking out very far, and created some scenarios that really are going to help AEM to drive its services, but also to help inform our members as they look into markets that they want to serve to best make sure that we are responding to the needs that the customers have out there. And the third benefit of that is that we make this available to the public for just to spur those conversations, whether it's with a policymaker or just the general public. People love to talk about the future, and when you can put tangible pieces of information out there of where food is going to come from or what's happening on the innovation space within agriculture, it's a really fun conversation that allows us to move from what has historically been a defensive posture when we move to policymakers saying, hey, we're on the offense, we're doing some really fun things, come join us and make it easier for us to feed the world in a more sustainable way.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I grew up on a family farm in Indiana that has continued to remain in the family for over 100 years, thus qualifying it as a Hoosier homestead.
Bill Hoglund, Senior Vice President, Bipartisan Policy Center. A recent moderator for a Farm Foundation forum focused on farm food and the policies and practices behind America's dietary health.
My undergraduate degree was in econ at Purdue. As Martha said, I am currently with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Bipartisanship is not an oxymoron for us. The founders of the center, the late Senators Bob Dole and Howard Baker on the Republican side, and George Mitchell and Tom Daschle on the Democratic side, they truly believed, and we truly believe, that sustainable policy is best achieved when it is done in a bipartisan way. And historically, it has been farm policy in this country has been done with broad bipartisan buy-in. But it's clear this is a highly polarized political environment that we are experiencing today. And it's not exactly clear how the 2023 Farm Bill will fare in this environment. There are many interrelated, interacting issues that will be brought to the surface as we enter the debate next year, from conservation to climate to energy to commodity support to trade, and yes, nutrition and diet. First, you should know that the 2023 Farm Bill will likely be the first Farm Bill in our country's history, which will top $1 trillion. And second, you should know that nearly 80% of that bill's funding will be directed toward the nutrition title. Also, you should probably be aware, if you're not already, that President Biden just last week announced that we will have a White House conference on food, nutrition, health, and hunger this September. And this will be the first such White House conference since President Nixon's White House conference in 1969 on that same subject. And that resulted in a number of major federal policies impacting diet and federal food programs.
One of the panelists, Dr. Robert Parlberg, author of Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat.
I'm going to be sharing a message from my new book, which is titled Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat. It's a message that's directed at farm organizations and at agribusiness companies. And it may sound a little bit harsh, but that's why the subtitle of my book is called Straight Talk. My advice to farm and agribusiness organizations is to, frankly, stop bragging about the fact that America's food system is the safest, the most abundant, and the most affordable in the world. That's all true. But this kind of talk today falls flat in places like New York and San Francisco and Boston, where I live, because our current food system is producing too many unhealthy results. Too much of the food sold in supermarkets and at restaurants is bad for our health. And if farmers and agribusiness companies don't start showing more concern, they're going to be blamed for this result. In fact, to an extent, they already are.
What can be done? What's the solution?
If farm organizations start showing more concern about America's dietary health crisis today, it's going to be harder for critics to blame you for that crisis, which is what they're doing.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As we know, we're dealing with an $822 trillion piece of the world's economy.
He's the chairman of the House Ag Committee from Georgia, David Scott.
That is what's on the table here today.
It's easy to focus on the upside potential, but he warns there's more at stake here.
While the proposed clearing model by FTX is limited in a select few cryptocurrency contracts, we must consider the potential of this model to expand into other derivatives markets and adopted in some form by other clearinghouses. Further, I am greatly concerned, and this worries me, about the potential of this proposal to upset international agreements that the CFTC and this committee have worked so hard to preserve, which have deemed our current clearing structure and regulations equivalent to EU and UK rules, affording us derivatives clearing organizations the ability to provide clearing services in their markets.
Terry Duffy, CEO of the CME Group, looks at where this FTX proposal adds more risk.
The gentleman at the end of the table said that 90% of the crypto market is going overseas, I would assure you that 90% of the losses are also going overseas with them. And that's not a bad thing from our perspective of our participants being protected from this. Listen, these asset classes are completely different, and I'm not here to discuss the value of crypto one way or another. I think what's important is the structure that they operate under. The proposal as put forth is fraught with dangers. The traditional clearing model that we deploy at CME Group is something that we are passionate about, and the gentleman referred to the derivatives industry cratering in 2008, and what caused that. I assure you it wasn't listed derivatives industry. It was levered bilateral derivatives that caused that collapse. So the risk associated with these products, if not properly regulated, could be catastrophic, not only for the risk of their products, but other products that this application could be applied to, especially every asset class that CME trades. So I have grave concerns. I could talk for hours on this topic, Mr. Chairman. I'll reserve my time, but I think as you deploy this against other asset classes, that's where the real risks come in.
Walt Lukin is the president and CEO of the Futures Industry Association.
Well, as far as customer protection, I mean, the FCM over the years has played a critical role in our ecosystem of making sure that customers are protected, their funds are segregated, that they're guaranteeing those funds, they're holding capital in case there's a default. So we have this layer of protection, as was noted, that helps protect customers that exist that's being taken out of the system. So yeah, I think FTX is making the argument that they can replicate that in other ways through the DCO application. But we have strong views that there's a reason that FCMs help to compartmentalize risk away from the CCP. You know, oftentimes they're holding that capital to try to, like a ship that may be taking on water. You close the watertight hatch, right, to make sure the rest of the ship does not go down.
Right.
We think that diversified risk that the FCM provides is a helpful component of preventing a systemic event and helping protect customers.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Last year, we submitted an amendment to our clearing order, which would allow us to operate as almost every other clearinghouse does with margin.
Sam Bankman-Fried is founder and CEO of FTX U.S. Derivatives.
We have spent tens of thousands of hours talking with the commission about this proposal and thousands of pages of documents. We really, really deeply respect the thorough process that the CFTC has undergone, the amount of time that they have spent digging into the details of our proposal, challenging it where appropriate, and the seriousness with which they are treating this this proposal. We respect the CFTC and their process and whatever conclusions they ultimately come to. I will note that while our proposal does combine things together in a way that I think might bring powerful innovation to the space, each of the elements already exists in CFTC-licensed derivatives exchanges, including ICE NGX, LedgerX, and others. I believe that the amendment that we put forward would help promote healthy markets. I think that would promote fair and equitable access to platforms. In particular, traditional exchanges charge for market data such that only the largest traders are able to get full knowledge of the markets that they are supposed to be trading on. With FTX, all of our market data is 100% free, transparent, and public. All users, regulators, and other observers have full access to our market data. Traditional exchanges have separate models for the largest traders and for other users such that only the largest traders have direct access with lower latency fees and more options. We would have equitable access to our platform where all users can choose the method of access that they most prefer and have access to the most powerful tools. We also have strong customer protections under our model. It is a safe and conservative risk model which would have helped to alleviate some of the instances that we've seen with recent future exchanges, like the LME Nickel fiasco earlier this year, by having the collateral pre-funded at the clearinghouse rather than relying on credit, and having a real-time risk engine. We also have enhanced customer protections. We have all of the customer protections that exist on traditional futures exchanges and on FCMs because we understand deeply that we have a responsibility to ensure that if there is direct access to the platform, that users are still afforded the same level of protection. On top of that, we have further customer protection, suitability, and transparency than what you find on most other platforms. Finally, we believe that this would bring competition and innovation. It would bring liquidity to the U.S. marketplace and options to U.S. consumers. It would bring competition in the futures market, where almost all of the volume is traded by just two exchanges. And it would bring competitiveness to the United States with respect to the rest of the world. Today, 95% of digital asset volume trades overseas. And that brings me to some of the broader context here. Digital asset marketplaces need federal oversight. They need that oversight to protect consumers, to protect against systemic risk, to bring liquidity back onshore, to ensure U.S. competitiveness globally. This is good for the U.S. economy, for Americans, for wealth creation, and good for our consumers. The CFTC is an appropriate regulator to provide this for digital asset futures contracts. They have been doing so on CME and other platforms for a number of years. They're a thorough regulator who understands this space very deeply.
He testified Thursday in front of the House Ag Committee. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Now, my warning to farm and agribusiness groups is that this dietary health crisis is increasingly blamed on farms, on what American farms grow.
Dr. Robert Parlberg is an author and a recent guest at a Farm Foundation forum.
For example, here's a quote from Michael Pollan, who is the single most influential journalist covering America's food system ever since his 2006 bestseller, Omnivore's Dilemma. Pollan says, we create incentives for farmers to grow huge quantities of corn and soy, mostly in the Midwest. Corn and soy is really where the calories in most of the junk food come from. We have inadvertently created a system where the cheapest calories in the supermarket are the least healthy. Pollan has popularized this notion that America's bad diet comes from the excessive quantities of corn and soy that are, he says, promoted by farm subsidies in the United States. Most of my students out in the East Coast believe this. This is for them the gospel. They know that farm subsidies promote the production of unhealthy foods on America's farms, and that they say we're living under a plague of cheap corn, and that that's the reason our diet is in trouble.
Talks about what he thinks is part of the problem.
Policies of the federal government today make the price of all of these products artificially high, not artificially low. We have tariff rate quotas on sugar imports that keep the price of sugar in the U.S. market 65% above the world market price. We have a conservation reserve program that allows wheat growers in Kansas to take their land out of production for 10 years at a time, pushing up the price of wheat while they get rental payments for that idled land. For corn, we don't have a plague of cheap corn. We have a renewable fuel standard for ethanol that diverts nearly a third of our corn crop out of the food supply completely for use in producing auto fuel. This pushes the price of corn up by about 30%, and crops that are grown on the same land as corn, like soybeans, price of those crops goes up by about 20%. As for meat, well, because corn and soy are animal feeds and because they're artificially expensive, the price of meat is artificially high as well. Same for dairy. Feed costs drive up dairy prices. We also have federal milk marketing orders for dairy that stabilize prices, but usually in an upward direction.
But it's clear farmers' reputations are at risk.
So notice what I'm saying. Our unhealthy eating does not come from farms. It does not even come from farm subsidies. It doesn't come from food deserts. It doesn't come from healthy food that's too expensive. It largely comes from what food companies do to farm commodities after they leave the farm. Farm organizations and agribusiness companies are being blamed for our poor dietary health when the real troublemakers are food manufacturing companies. So, next slide. This leads me to offer in the end some practical political advice to farm organizations and agribusiness companies. I think it's time to loosen your traditional political alliance with food companies. They may be your customer, but they're engaging in practices that put your reputation now at risk.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
High gas prices and energy prices. My plan is already in motion. I led the world and other countries to join with us to coordinate the largest release of oil from our stockpiles of all the countries in history. 240 million barrels to boost global supply.
President Joe Biden speaking on Wednesday.
Here at home, U.S. oil and gas production is approaching record levels. In fact, we produced more oil domestically in my first year in office than my predecessor did in his first year. To further drive down prices, my administration is allowing the sale of gasoline using homegrown biofuels this summer, which wasn't allowed before. And to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and reckless autocrats like Putin, I'm working with Congress to pass landmark investments to help build a clean energy future as well.